you have a case of spring weather whiplash? Has some of your foliage been nipped by frost? This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Today on our gardening show, we'll talk about what these big temperature swings mean for our gardens, along with yellow-bellied sapsuckers, soil health, and of course, our experts are here to answer your questions. Joining me today are University of Cincinnati Interim Dean for Natural Sciences, Teresa Cully, Ohio State University Assistant Professor of Entomology and Hamilton County Extension Educator, Joe Boggs, and Hamilton County Conservation District Agriculture Specialist, Nicole Gunderman. Thank you all for being here today.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Joe, I understand the yellow-bellied sapsucker is passing through Ohio. I want to make sure we talk about this so I can say yellow-bellied sapsuckers a few times during the show. Where are they coming from and where are they heading?
Wow. You know, that name really does sound strange, doesn't it? Sounds like something you'd say to somebody you didn't like, right?
Right.
Well, they spend the winter. They're one of our more extreme migratory birds, and they are a woodpecker, and they're the only woodpecker that has such a large migratory pathway that we find in Ohio. So they go all the way down to Central America, all through Mexico, Central America, and the West Indies. That's where they spend the winter. You know, wouldn't you like to do that? I mean, you know, just go down to Cancun or something and hang out. And in the spring, they reverse course, fly through areas like Ohio to go up into a very large swath of Canada where they nest and breed. And so then in the fall, they reverse and back and forth. So they're really long-range flyers. And this time of year, they're passing through. And they get their name because, yes, indeed, they do peck holes in the bark of trees. They wait till sap wells up. And here's kind of an interesting thing. They're the only other animal besides us that specifically taps trees for sap.
So there are competition?
Kind of, I guess. Now you say that. They can disrupt vascular flow. There's a lot of debate as to just how much of an impact they make. But here's why we really do want people to be aware of this. First of all, they're considered very, very important in ecosystem speaking. They're considered keystone species in both their Canadian breeding site and their wintering sites. So they're very important for those ecosystems. And that's because they don't only tap sap, but they also attract a lot of different things coming to those sap wells, including insects. And they don't then just feed on sap. They also feed on the insects that are attracted to that sap that wells up in the wells. At the end of the day, though, how much harm do they really do? And as I said, that's open to debate. The research indicates that perhaps they go after trees that are already having some difficulties, which partially explains why we see more damage in landscapes compared to forests, where our trees typically are doing a little better. But the final and most important point, I meant to make this point a while ago, is that these holes are always arranged in horizontal rows, or sometimes vertical rows, and they get mistaken for emergence holes by wood-boring insects. But when you stop and think about it, you know, that doesn't make a lot of sense, because how would these insects all get together and synchronize their emergence and say, well, we got to be in a row, you know, just all at once? So they do get mistaken for that, but they're very interesting birds.
Yeah. Sounds like the synchronized, it could be synchronized swimming of the insect world, the boring insect world. It's like insect Olympics, and we're just assuming it's these yellow-bellied sapsuckers. We are talking about.
I never thought of that.
See, there you go. There's another area to research for you, Joe.
I'm writing that down right now. We don't call you Czarina for nothing.
Well, now I finally got called Czarina.
There you go.
Yeah. Well, we're talking about gardening for the full hour, and we've got experts here who can answer your questions. Give us a call at 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. So, Teresa, would you characterize these birds as friends or foes? Are they a little bit of each when it comes to the plant side of things?
Oh, I would say definitely they're more on the friend side.
Okay.
Like Joe had mentioned, I mean, they do I don't know if damage is the right word, to the trees, because the tree is huge. And so this is just a normal part of the whole ecosystem. And so they're, you know, as Joe had mentioned, they're known as a keystone species. And so they're very important. So and they're critical just for the normal functioning of that entire forest. So although there might be an immediate like negative impact to the tree, I think overall it's totally fine.
Okay. Okay. Good. Well, Nicole, you are with the Hamilton County Conservation District. It's your first time on the show, so welcome to the gardening show.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Yeah, great to have you here. Can you give us an overview of the resources that the Conservation District has available to the community? You all offer a lot of stuff.
Sure. Yeah, we absolutely do. So the Hamilton County Conservation District is a public organization, and we serve Hamilton County. Some people might think of or know, be more familiar with soil and water. So there is a soil and water conservation district for every county in Ohio, every county actually in the U.S. So don't worry, listeners, if you're not in Hamilton County, there is a soil and water conservation district for you in Butler or Warren or Claremont. And in other states. So anyway, yeah, but we are stewards of soil and water resources, and we're providing education and technical assistance and leadership when it comes to all things soil and water. So I'm the agriculture specialist, so I'm focused on agriculture, but there are other folks in my office who are doing some regulation and permitting for construction sites, making sure that soil and water are protected there. We have a fleet of folks who are doing education programs for youth, you know, kindergarten through 12th grade. And then we also have a stream specialist focusing on water quality and monitoring.
Okay. Well, speaking of streams, we already have a question. This is from JR, who's in Lebanon. JR says, my question has to do with removing invasive species in a riparian area. I keep cutting down the honeysuckle, mulberry, calorie pear, autumn olive, multiflora, and they all seem to respond well to pruning at the stump. Sigh. What suggestions do you have for me? I'll start with you, Teresa.
Yeah, no, this is a really great question. So I always say plants are amazing, and this is one example of some plants, especially those that are invasive, can really come back. And so I always tell people something like the calorie pear, amber honeysuckle, if you just cut it and just walk away, that actually encourages the plant to even grow back faster. And instead of a tree, for example, you'll get a big bush. And so really what it comes down to is if you can, you want to remove the plant while it's still young and you could still yank it up. If you do this with honeysuckle, for example, you need to remove the small little sapling. If it's small enough, you can pull it up. You do not lay it on the ground because it can root back in. I actually take them and I hang them in trees as I walk along. And
wow,
so,
is it like a warning to the other
honeysuckle? It looks a little weird.
Effigy.
Oh, yeah, yeah, an effigy. So yeah.
That explains it.
Yeah. So if anyone goes around and you see honeysuckle, that was me. Sorry.
I fled from a forest. I saw all that. I thought, oh, my
it's
gosh.
It's like the Blair Witch Project with honeysuckle.
That's exactly what I was worried about.
The other – so normally in these types of situations, it is unfortunately something where herbicides are necessary. Mm. However, you had talked about a riparian area, and
yes,
that is a really important distinction because that is a very critical habitat where we have amphibians. We have to be very careful what we do. And so if you have a problem and you've just tried to remove this plant over and over and it's not working, what I would recommend, and again, this isn't my first go-to thing, but in this particular case, an herbicide might be necessary. And for that, you do not want to use Roundup. You want to use an alternative that can be is more safer near riparian areas. And so that would be Rodeo. Yeah. Different words.
Yeah.
But the other important point, too, is you have to be very careful in the application. You do not want to just spray it indiscriminately. What we do is we actually go to the plant. You cut it. Within about 10 minutes or so, you need to – I have a very dilute solution of this in a hand sprayer, or spray it right on there. There's like what are called dabbers, I think mm-hmm. is what it is, these tubes with little sponges. You can dab it on the cut portion of the stem. The other nice thing is if you could put a dye in it, apparently Joe likes red.
I use blue.
I use blue.
Yeah. And so people can see right away that's already been treated. And so then you're just very carefully placing that chemical on the plant itself. Again, it's very important that you use the right chemical, the right dosage. I use as low dosage as I can, and making sure that you apply it directly to the cut portion within a 10-minute period. And that 10 minutes is because the plant, for about 10 minutes, it doesn't realize it's been cut. So it just continues to absorb all the chemicals into its vascular system. And so that's the amount of time that you have. I don't know.
I have a follow-up question, not a call-in. I'm just right here in the studio. But it's my understanding that this time of year, with honeysuckle in particular, that they're sending so much of their sap up from the roots that it can actually push out any type of an herbicide.
Yeah, that very good. Yeah, thank you. That's a good point. A lot of these herbicides are best used at the end of the season. So, for example, for honeysuckle, we usually do in the preserve that I manage for UC is we do it the second Saturday of November, for example. So you do have to be careful. That's a really good point.
Yeah. Well, and especially that the type of herbicide we were talking before the show that you use is so important because it can get into that water source that's in this environment, right? So you have to be really careful about what you're using, when you do it, all those things.
Yeah. And if necessary, people can just, you can just keep cutting the plant, but it's going, I mean, honestly, it's going to take a very long time before the plant just gives up and poops out and has no energy.
Yeah. You might give up before the plant does.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, JR, I hope that helps. And you might have to put up with that honeysuckle until the fall, it sounds like, to use the treatment that you suggested.
You can't. I'll just add in, we have had some success with, you can go in and cut the honeysuckle and then it's going to start to grow back. So you can immediately get rid of, you know, the overgrowth you want to. It just means in the fall, you're going to have to come back and do it again.
Okay. Okay. Great. Well, you can ask your questions too, because we've got gardening experts here for the full hour. Give us a call with your questions or comments at 513-419-7100. Excuse me. Or you can email talk@wvxu.org. Nicole, I want to come back to you. You were talking about the kind of training you offer, the different, all the different things you all offer. What do you offer for urban gardeners, urban farmers? There are all kinds of resources for those people, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So a first opportunity would be to go to our website. So you can Google the Hamilton County Conservation District or go to hcswcd.org. It stands for Hamilton County Soil and Water Conservation District. And there's a button on there or a drop down where you can find the agriculture pages. And there are all sorts of resources on there. A resource page where you can self-select what type of gardener or farmer you are and then find just links to area and both local and statewide or national opportunities, training, education, sometimes grant opportunities and things like that. And then I also have an agriculture-specific newsletter called Let's Grow Hamilton County. And you do need to subscribe. You can do that on that page as well. And it only comes out 6 times a year. So the next issue will come out here in May. And I'm always trying to uplift not just the programs we offer at the district, but also area partners, nonprofits, other agencies, folks who are educating and providing opportunities. So that's a great one-stop shop. And then at the district, we do offer programs and workshops. We actually have a rain barrel workshop coming up on May 18th, and that will be at our training center. That's in collaboration with the Regional Stormwater Collaborative and their Save Local Waters campaign. So there is a charge for the rain barrel, but it is subsidized if you come take the class. So it's $85 if you just want to purchase a rain barrel, and it's $55 if you come and learn about rain barrel best practices in installation and maintenance and all of that. But I offer programs for producer growers, farmers directly, folks who are, you know, engaged in agriculture as a business, and then also for backyard gardeners and homesteaders or someone who might just be growing one tomato in a pot on their porch. So coming up in July, I'll have a cover crop program for small gardens. So how to integrate cover crops, really focusing on conservation best practices. So I'm not trying to duplicate what a lot of our partners are doing in the area and in the region. I instead want to kind of offer that conservation lens or focus.
That makes sense. Well, we have a caller on the line. Hi, Summer. Thanks for listening. Thanks for calling. What is your question?
Well, not a question, but a tag-on comment about the honeysuckle. I have issues with those as well. And I have found that I use a long, skinny tree spade. And this time of year when the soil is soft, I just pop them out of the ground and get the roots out, and I'm done with them.
Oh, that'll teach them, huh, Summer?
Yeah, well, even you know, decent-sized ones, but I try and keep after them when they're small. You know, I understand sometimes there is a need for chemicals when one is just a monster. But I just thought I would offer that alternative to eradicating honeysuckles. And they're not hard to dig out. You know, they're very shallow root and pretty easy to get out when the soil is soft. But you got to get them now, because once it gets into summer, the ground is so hard, they're no fun to get out.
Well, thank you, Summer. That is a great tip. We appreciate that. Joe, do you like the scoop them out by the roots technique?
I do, but there's a real challenge there. And Teresa, correct me if I'm wrong. I mean, you've never done that before, but now you can do that, right? Underground stems, rhizomes, don't they produce rhizomes?
No, not there. I mean, it's just going to be an underground stem, I think. We're talking plant terminology, Joe. Yeah. You're trying to make...
Yes, I know.
But what the caller had mentioned is important. We call that a honeysuckle popper.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can purchase those in some, or you can make it yourself.
Okay.
Yeah.
Great. Well, thanks, Summer. We appreciate that. And now we have Lauren. Hey, Lauren. Thanks for calling. What's your question?
Hi. I'm wondering if there have been any new advancements with controlling lesser celandine. I know it has grown up in my neighborhood around the little stream, and it seems like pulling it doesn't seem to be making much of a difference.
Okay, that's a great question, Joe. Yeah, you said wow, and I was getting wow looks on the faces of the people in the studio. So, Joe, do you want to break the bad news to Lauren?
Yeah, Lauren, the very sad news is that, well, okay, let's start with good news.
Okay.
They're called spring ephemerals for a reason. And that's fantastic that they are, because, you know, they show themselves in the spring and then they disappear. And I mean, totally disappear. So they're not with us the entire season. They're not a perennial in the way that we think of perennials that hang out, you know, all season long and go to seed. The downside, though, is, of course, they do compete with our native spring ephemerals, which, you know, we call those wildflower displays in the spring. And so we see suppression there. There have not been really any advancements that I'm aware of. You're absolutely correct. Trying to dig them out, they have these potato-like structures underground that they produce heavily that are bulbs that then can give rise to new plants. And then they also have these other structures that are up in the plant, in the stem axials, that are called barbels, which function in a similar way. The barbels, though, get picked up by deer in the dew claws. They can be moved about very easily. And that's actually one way that this plant spreads. The other good news is that they're not known for being seed producers. Teresa, kick in on this. I find the research very, very fascinating, because apparently some patches, you know, we can see a little bit of seed, but overall that's not very common. Is that correct, Teresa? I think that we've talked about that.
Yeah. Mostly it's through vegetative spread.
Yeah.
And so, yeah. Joe, I was sort of laughing because you were saying barbells, and I was thinking deer running around with little barbells.
That's right. They have little bells. You can hear them coming.
Yeah. But what it is, Joe's totally right. There's these little structures on them sort of above the soil surface on the plant, and I call them bulbels. But
tomato.
Yeah, exactly. Anyways,
I think I mispronounced those. Thank you. I was waiting for you to correct me one time, and this is fantastic. Yes, you're right. They are bulbels.
So,
I like the barbells, though.
I know. I do like the barbells. So what happens, though, is you're right that they can be spread very easily. Also, what we've seen is that people spread these because they see these plants. They think they're beautiful. They are beautiful, honestly. Mm-hmm. And then they'll pull them up. There is only one subspecies that produces these bulbuls, but it's the one that's all over the place.
Yeah.
The other point that Joe had, he was right that it's a spring ephemeral. And so they form this like lush carpet all over the place. and then they disappear. What you're not seeing is mm-hmm. that when they form the lush carpet, they're essentially smothering everything else. And so that's what Joe was talking about with the wildflowers. So in areas where we see the lesser celandine, in a few years, pretty much your trillium, your violets, everything else is gone. And so it's a huge problem. The question was how to get rid of it.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where I think we were all rolling our eyes, being like, oh, this is a tough one.
Yeah.
It doesn't respond very well to chemicals. People have tried it. One point is it grows in layers, so you can kill off the top layer and the next layer comes up. So that can be a problem. I've heard of people trying fire, and I haven't heard any good things about
flowers.
That. What I tend to do is the minute I see that, I just dig it up.
And but it's don't put it in your compost.
And don't put it in your compost. Excellent point. And when you dig it up, don't pull it by the roots. I literally get a shovel and I go below the plant, several inches below it.
How deep is this? Like a 6-foot hole?
No,
like how deep do you have?
No, I'm not that crazy. So it might be, I don't know, maybe like 2 inches underneath
it.
You know, not totally crazy. But I put it in a plastic bag and I put it in my trash. And you're totally right. We definitely do not want to put that in your yard waste because that just spreads it all over. Those things are really hard to kill even once it goes through the yard waste program.
Mm-hmm.
It's a nasty plant. And really, the minute you see it, one little seedling, like just dig all around it and get that out of there.
Mm.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Joe.
Well, and you know, I hate to say this, but we've talked about this before on the show, where at some point it's kind of the same with honeysuckle. Teresa, I really like what you said, that, you know, these plants really show us, you know, how tough these plants are, you know, because of the way they've evolved. And you just can't fight Mother Nature, you know, when it comes right down to it. So herbicides have been used. Glyphosate's been used in a trial down in Virginia where, you know, the application has to occur at peak bloom, but it's not 1 year. And the other challenge is that where these have been, these tests and trials, they typically get overrun within just a few years back. So you come in, you get a place cleaned up after a lot of effort. And then here's the other challenge. You got to be careful if you have spring ephemerals coming up mm-hmm. at the same time. You know, your Dutchman breeches, for example, I find them very commonly in our area growing right in with the lesser celandine. You're going to wipe those out mm-hmm. too. So this is one where I'm just afraid that we're going to have to step back and say, well, it's bad for now. Now, of course, nature abhors a vacuum and something may come along eventually, you know, that will help us to fight this back. I'm not aware of anything yet. Are you, Teresa? I mean,
no.
I'm going to share
something that is absolutely not scientific and is really anecdotal. But shout out to my colleague, Rachel, who has found some success with planting, with actually seeding Dutch white clover.
Hmm.
And that the Dutch white clover can outcompete the lesser celandine. But this is in one person's yard.
Okay.
Well, that's interesting.
Yeah. We have to take a break. Lauren, I hope that helps. Good luck with this lesser celandine. We know what you're up against and we're rooting for you.
Yeah.
We will be back with our gardening show after a short break. If you've got questions, now's a good time to call 513-419-7100 or you can email talk@wvxu.org. This is Cincinnati Edition. You're listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. We're back with our gardening show. My guests are Ohio State Hamilton County Extension Educator Joe Boggs, Hamilton County Conservation District Agriculture Specialist Nicole Gunderman, and University of Cincinnati Professor of Plant Biology Teresa Cully. If you've got questions for them, and we know you have questions for them, give us a call at 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. We've gotten some emails that have come in. Carissa writes, I have two large raised garden beds 4 feet by 8 feet each. What kind of soil do I need to have in those beds, please? And what's the best option for finding or buying that in the Cincinnati area? Nicole, I know you're all about the soil. So what do you think?
Soil is my jam.
Don't put it on toast, though.
No. That's a good question, Carissa. So yes, and the very short answer would be it depends on what you're trying to grow. But assuming that you are probably going to be doing some type of mixed vegetables, there are a variety of different places and sources around the region where you can source a high quality garden mix, some topsoil, you know, putting the bags, you can buy bagged soil, you know, at a lawn or a greenhouse or garden center. And if you need a larger amount, which it sounds like you might, you can access some of those resources on our website, places where you could get it in a larger quantity. And then if you're getting fresh soil, you know, you're setting yourself up for success there with a raised bed. If you've had raised beds with soil in them for a while, where you've been growing over time, you might want to consider doing a soil fertility test. And then definitely if you're growing in the ground and especially in an urban setting.
And a soil fertility test, that's something that you all can handle?
Yes, that is through our office. We run the Hamilton County Soil Fertility Testing Program.
Okie doke. We got a question from Ginger. Ginger asks, how do I prevent fungus gnats on my houseplants? Ginger has a money tree, but is looking to add more houseplants to her home. In the event that she does get gnats, she wonders what can she do to get rid of them? Joe, I know you are a defender of all things buggy and gnatty, but what advice do you have for Ginger?
Well, I really appreciate the uptick. I mean, finally an insect. You know, we all got crushed with the lesser celandine, I tell you. So fungus gnats, as their name implies, have a very strong tie to, you know, fungi in the soil, which, of course, has a very strong tie to wet soils. So the only way really realistically that you're going to be able to get rid of them would be to allow your houseplant soils to dry down to the place where when you put your finger in there, they really feel dry. Now, that will help over time to start suppressing the immatures, the maggots of these gnats. It won't happen immediately, but over time it will help. Now, with that, though, you need to make sure that you have great drainage for your potted plants. So if you really have a fungus gnat problem, I recommend that people might want to consider repotting and check things out. Because the final thing, fungus gnats can indicate that you're starting to experience root rots in those pots. And of course, that'll eventually lead to getting rid of the fungus gnats because you have no houseplants. So, you know, make sure to just check that out. I would, like I say, first let them dry down. If you start seeing, though, as you're letting them dry down, that the plants are really wilting quickly, that may signal that you have some root damage going on because of root rots that are supported by too much moisture. But over time, you'll find the fungus gnats will disappear if you just keep that soil dry between watering. And that's the final recommendation, is lengthen the period between watering, let it dry, you know, really dry down, water, and then let it dry down. And most people, myself included, because I've experienced fungus gnats, not on purpose as an entomologist. You might think, oh, well, you know, we like them. But they're terrible things, a real nuisance. And it always goes back to, I just got a little carried away with watering. Most of my houseplants, frankly, I water only about every 3 weeks.
Okay. Did you want to add something, Teresa?
Yeah, I just want to chime in. Joe's totally right. I've also been dealing from time to time with fungus gnat problems. Usually it's because if I buy a discounted plant from a store and I bring it back and then I wish I didn't. Things that have helped me in addition to what Joe said is what you also want to do is you're trying to break the cycle of the adults flying, reproducing, laying eggs, and so forth. And so one of the things I've done is you want to essentially nail the adults flying around. So if you have, you know, there's fly paper that you could use. I use some of these lights that you can plug in, sticky traps, and it attracts them. And so that could be really helpful. Another thing that I've tried is actually using, I saw this online, it seems to work, is using the mosquito dunks, you know, the little things that you could put into your water barrels. And it's BT, so it's actually, you know, natural, if you will. And you could take a part of that, you dissolve in like a gallon of water, and then you use that as a soil drench. So when you do water your plants, like what Joe said, you want to dry them out, but when you do water them, then you water them with this special drench.
Mm.
And so the BT in that water then will go naturally attack the little larva of the fungus gnats. And so usually within about 2 weeks, you can see a distinct improvement and hopefully they disappear.
Okay.
You know, I have to interrupt because I like the sticky, you know, the sticky trap idea because, you know, now let's think about this. You have all these little gnats stuck to it. You can kind of taunt them like in Monty Python style, right? You can gnats. You can gnats. Get out of here. I will taunt you a second time.
Okay.
Sorry. Well, that's, there we go. Too much coffee, obviously.
That's right. Well, we now have Yvonne on the phone. Hey, Yvonne. Thanks so much for calling. What's your question?
Yes, hi. So my neighbor... I don't want to think that he did it on purpose, but I'm pretty sure he did. He planted bamboo, and now it's spreading into my yard, and I've been fighting it for about 3 years now, and I cannot get rid of it. Can you give me any tips on how to get rid of the bamboo in my yard?
Teresa?
Lucy, can we say, Yvonne, you're breaking up? We couldn't hear the question.
Yeah, that
bamboo.
Yeah, no.
He's
teasing you, Yvonne, because he doesn't want to answer that question. But Teresa raised her hand, so good news for you.
I will try. So first of all, I'll say there's two types of bamboos, so we need to be clear about that. There is a running bamboo, which it sounds like you are unfortunately experiencing. There's also a clumping bamboo, and there's different types, so you can buy them in the store. The clumping bamboo, honestly, is not that much of a problem. It stays where it is. It's the running bamboo that literally sends out runners, and it can go through anything. It can go under fences. It can do all these sorts of things, and oftentimes that does become a neighbor issue if the bamboo is running from one yard to the next, which it will. You know, plants don't care about fences, so they're just going where they will. So there's two different things I would tell you. One is if you want to tackle the bamboo yourself, essentially you're going to have to dig a trench down almost a foot and put in some type of plastic or metal, you know, to keep the roots, the runners from running by. The other thing is I will note that bamboo is currently on the invasive species list for the state of Ohio. So it's regulated but it's only in a very specific condition when essentially this type of situation, when it's getting out from one neighbor to another, when it's not cared for.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's also something that can now be handled through the local township, if you will. But I would recommend, I mean, of course, talking to your neighbor. If you don't have a great relationship, obviously, then you're going to have to try to tackle the plant yourself.
Yeah.
But there are options.
Okay.
But it is difficult.
Yeah. Well, good luck, Yvonne. We got to take another quick break. We sure hope you get that bamboo under control. We are rooting for you also. We'll be back after a short break to wrap up our gardening show. If you've got questions, time is running short. Call 513-419-7100 or you can email talk@wvxu.org. This is Cincinnati Edition. You're tuned to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. We're back with today's gardening show. My guests are Hamilton County Conservation District Agriculture Specialist Nicole Gunderman, University of Cincinnati Professor of Plant Biology Teresa Cully, and Ohio State University Assistant Professor of Entomology and Hamilton County Extension Educator Joe Boggs. They're ready for your questions. Call 513-419-7100 or you can email talk@wvxu.org. And I will tell you, we have callers lined up. We're going to enter the lightning round. So we're going to have one answer per caller. Let's start with Renee. Hi, Renee. Thanks so much for your patience. What's your question?
Oh, hi. No problem. Thanks for taking the call. I have barnyard grass in my lawn in the city. I don't have a barn or a farm, and I have barnyard grass. My lawn people say that I cannot get rid of it unless I pull it out by the root, and it is essentially everywhere and spreads rapidly. So I'm hoping somebody has another idea besides taking up my entire lawn by the root.
Mm. Joe, do you have any other advice for Renee?
Wow. Yeah, it's a non-native invasive, and it is a real problem. Now, the good news is this, that let me ask, is she still on?
I don't know if I can get her back because I put her on hold. Well, I'm not good with these buttons.
typically it appears in clumps. It typically appears as distinct plants first. In turf grass. And, you know, it's time consuming, but you can do it going around and actually kind of doing the thing we talked about, with the honeysuckle in terms of just popping individual plants out. I know that used to be tried and sometimes successfully, with things like dandelions. So that's one option. Unfortunately, the other option has to do with killing everything toward at the end of the season. When I say end of the season, I'm actually talking about like in August, but you start the first application in July. If you have a lawn care service, they can do that. And then slit seeding and introducing turf grass back. That's a difficult thing to do, but hopefully these are individual plants that you can pop out. We do not have an herbicide that will take out that plant specifically without hurting your lawn. So that's the real challenge with barnyard grass.
Mm, good luck, Renee. That sounds like a tough one. I hope you get it figured out. We now have Clifford on the line. Hi, Clifford. Thank you for your patience. What's your question?
Hi. I live in Clifton, about an eighth of a mile from the university in Vernon Woods, along maybe a 10-acre woodlot that's infested with winter creeper, tree of heaven, kudzu. I was just looking to see if I could point it in the right direction to perhaps get some help clearing it all out, because it's such a huge undertaking that's for one person to just do. So, I'll just listening to see if you guys could point me in the right direction with maybe some volunteer help or some other resources I can contact.
Okay. Thanks, Clifford. Appreciate the question.
So, Clifford, I don't know if he's on. If you're talking about, I think I heard you say it's near Burnett Woods, not in Burnett Woods. So what I would recommend doing is there is a very active group in Burnett Woods that goes ahead and takes care of invasive plant removal. And so if you wanted to send me an email, maybe that's the easiest way to put you in touch with that group. Or you can, of course, just go and look online for Burnett Woods. And there's many different people there who would be able to help.
Yeah. And Clifford, if you want to send your email to talk@wvxu.org, we can connect you with Teresa. Thanks so much. And thanks for your interest in getting rid of those invasives. We have Mary on the line. Hi, Mary. What's your question?
Hi. Yes. I'm calling for my daughter. She has large maple trees in the backyard where the roots are now popping out of the ground, and they really don't want to do a large mulch bed. They're thinking about putting down rocks. I don't feel that that's healthy for the trees. Can she put down rocks?
Do you want me to take that? Or
sure,
Teresa,
Joe, go ahead.
Yeah, I want to see what Joe says.
All right. Well, first of all, 80% of a tree roots are, the feeder roots are in the upper 6 to 8 inches of the soil. So this idea that, that these surface roots are somehow the other abnormal isn't true. That's where the roots are. And so we don't want to interfere at all with those roots near the surface. They're there because there's a higher oxygen concentration in the soil near the surface of the soil. So then if we cover those over with anything, that can start interfering with oxygen penetrating the soil. And rocks, maybe, fine gravel, but of course now you're all of a sudden changing everything. They heat up, they're going to change that the environment for the roots. I know that you said that that they don't want to use mulch, but that is really your best friend, because mulch behaves almost exactly like what we see with leaf mulch in the soil in a forest. So that's what you're approximating. I wouldn't do anything Herculean, and certainly some people will believe that they're doing something good by cutting these roots, thinking they don't belong there, and that's absolutely the worst thing to do.
Well, I hope that helps, Mary. Good luck to your daughter. You're a good mom for calling in to try and get her some help. We appreciate you. We've got a bunch of other questions that are all stacked up here. Sarah was mowing her backyard when she came across an ant mound that was maybe 10 inches to a foot long. They're black ants, and the mound is not super close to the house, but is this something she should keep an eye on? She usually likes to leave things alone. Can she leave them alone in this case? Joe, you're the bug guy.
Yeah, those are called black field ants. They're very common. There's actually black, and then there's red. There's different colors, and they're different species. They're causing no harm whatsoever, other than the fact that the mounds can rise enough that you might hit it with a mower. That's still no harm, no foul. They'll just, they'll be a little mad at you, but they don't sting or anything like that. I don't believe, and Teresa, you may be thinking this too, that we do have to the east of us Allegheny mound ants, but the size isn't fitting. Yeah. Allegheny mound ants, we're talking like a foot or more above. So this sounds just like the black field ants, and they're good because they're out there just cleaning up after us.
Okay. We got a question from Marty. How to control hemlock? It's spreading all over. Teresa or Nicole, do you have ideas about that?
As in poison hemlock?
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking. Let's go with poison hemlock because that is spreading all
it
over.
It is spreading all over. Yeah.
Do you want to take a stab at it?
A bane of the farm communities as well. So, it kind of falls in line with a lot of what we've been saying about others as well. Removing it, you have to be extra, extra careful because it can cause irritation on your skin. I know that someone in the last couple of years got into real health crisis with weed whacking it. So do not weed whack or pulverize it, aerosolize it, have it be up in the air. But wearing protective clothing and eyewear and pulling it out or spraying, as we've discussed, and if you're near a riparian or waterway, using the rodeo and not regular glyphosate.
Yeah. Okay. Can I add one really quick thing?
Yeah.
I know we're running out of time. So what's the reason for this is it's a chemical called fluocoumarins in the plant. And when you cut it, it's released and it gets on your skin. It interacts with the UV light from the sun and it can actually start to cross-link the DNA in your cells.
Oh my gosh.
Fun fact.
Just a thing. Teresa, are you talking about poison hemlock or wild parsnip?
No, I'm talking about poison hemlock.
Oh my gosh.
Thinking poison hemlock or wild parsnip, Joe?
Yeah, that's what I always, that's where I always link that chemical to. And poison hemlock has some alkaloids that you have to ingest,
be right.
Yeah, what Nicole said a minute ago, but you said I was right so many times that I'm hoping this is recorded. I wanted to say, I'm hoping this is recorded because I'm listening to it over and over again. But what Nicole mentioned a while ago, though, and that is very important. There was a situation where an individual was using an electric chainsaw to cut down poison hemlock because the stems are very thick. And he did aerosolize it, was in the hospital for 109 days.
Oh, my gosh.
I spoke with the doctors. And it was very serious, but right now, both of these biennials are starting to bolt. So it takes 2 years in their life cycle. Right now, they're starting to, those second year plants are starting to bolt. They're starting to produce the part of the plant that will have the flowers and eventually the seed. So whatever you do right now is the thing to do it. And I just have to tell you, wild parsnip has yellow flowers, and that is really devastating in terms of causing skin injury. So you do not want to pull it. You really don't want to touch that plant.
Yeah,
so
good point.
In this case, herbicides are the best option, but follow up with trying to get something established that will compete. Grasses compete very well against these two non-native weeds.
Okay. We got a question from Rob. He was walking through the woods the other day and wondered if there was anything he could eat and how he might be able to identify it. Aren't there classes that for about foraging with regarding foraging? Is that the Civic Garden Center who offers those, or who offers those?
I think it's Cincinnati Nature Center.
Yeah.
Cincinnati
I was going to say,
yeah, okay. They do.
Okay.
Yeah, but with what we just talked about, it's good to take a class first, right?
Yes,
before
definitely.
You go out and just start foraging.
Yeah, don't just start eating stuff.
Definitely.
Yeah. Yes. We also got a question from Beth. She asks, what about Tordon for bamboo control?
Oh, I'm not the right person to ask on that one. I have heard about it being used, but honestly, yeah.
It'll do it, but that's, I mean, Tordon lasts for a very long time. It has high residual value, and so you're not going to be able to do a lot of planting there afterwards. It's a herbicide used a lot, you know, like, for example, along roadways and in industrial vegetation management. So I don't think I'd go that far.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We got an email from Rich. What about instead of applying herbicide to an entire lawn that you want to get rid of barnyard grass, instead putting plastic tarp or sheeting over the entire area? You think that might work, Nicole?
You definitely can use solarization or tarping. I mean, it's just going to take a lot longer, and you would have a long waiting time with a tarp and having that held down. And sometimes people aren't crazy about the optics of that as their lawn for the time period it would take, but it is certainly an option.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We have a question from Pat. We'll see if we can wrap this up. Pat asks, is there a good control for rose slugs? I mean, the sawfly larvae that are eating my rose leaves now. Is there maybe a control that will help prevent the next generation? Have any thoughts on that, Joe?
Yeah, actually, I posted a Buckeye Yard and Garden Line, BYGL. If you go there, I just posted it yesterday. The rose slug has one generation per year, and it's just about finished. So there's really nothing that needs to be done right now. Now, pay attention to your roses, because we have another non-native species called the bristly rose slug sawfly. Lucy, I'm not making these names up.
And, I don't believe you, but that's
but it
okay.
It has as many as five generations. And so pay close attention. The rose slug, one generation, is going to be gone very soon. And then the plants fill in. You won't even notice it. But if you have the bristly rose slug sawfly, so you see the damage continuing for another, you know, for a month, then you may want to use something like spinosad, which is an organic approach, won't kill other things, and it's very effective on sawflies.
I can't believe we got through all those questions. This was amazing.
You all are great.
You
had smart people except for me on here. That's the reason.
Well, I don't know if you can answer this in 30 seconds, Teresa, but are there any particular plants we should be worried about when we have a frost warning in the forecast these days?
Anything that is, I think, blooming right now. So if you're looking for fruit production, that's going to be a problem. Anything that's delicate, and I'm thinking like small herbs and things that you might, you know, a bedding plants that you might have, you're going to need to cover those or keep track of those. Mm-hmm. But it depends on where they're at. I have fuchsias on my front porch and they're doing fine right now, but they're covered, like they're next to the house. So you have to think about that.
Okay. Well, I have been talking with University of Cincinnati Interim Dean for Natural Sciences, Teresa Cully, Ohio State University Assistant Professor of Entomology and Hamilton County Extension Educator, Joe Boggs, and Hamilton County Conservation District Agriculture Specialist, Nicole Gunderman. Thank you all so much for your time today.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks a lot. It's been great fun.
Lots of fun, as always. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Harper Carlton. Technical director today is Stephen Baum. And Rob Fetters composed our theme music. I'm Lucy May. Thank you so much for listening.